Radio Gorgeous presents Gorgeous Lives. My guest today is a woman I worked with at BBC Bristol. I was a broadcast assistant and she was a presenter. And look how it's changed. Today I'm the presenter. How exciting. Welcome, media consultant and presenter, Susan Osman, to Radio Gorgeous.
Good afternoon, Josephine. I have to say, it's very lovely to see you again. I remember all those years ago, you manning the phones for the phone lines, and we were just reminiscing about the fun we had with our producer, who was completely barking mad, who we named Basil, if you remember. And she used to carry copious amounts of plastic bags around, stuffed with information. And people would kind of think, who is that bag lady? And of course, she was a Radio 4 Sony winning producer and produced our programme, The Morning Show.
She was an inspiration, actually, for Radio Gorgeous, I'll be honest.
Yeah. Really? How did that come?
Because it was a woman's programme, wasn't it? It's a magazine style.
Yeah, well, and primarily our listeners were women, you're quite right. Yeah. And our team was all women as well
yeah,
at the time.
Yeah. Remember Emma as well?
Yes, she's still there. She's
wow.
at the BBC. She does tours now.
God.
And she's, I think she's got two grandchildren who she's very, very proud of. And she was quite a character.
Yeah.
Oh, they were some funny times. Nine years we did that programme.
God, yeah, that's a long time.
It's a lot of fun.
It was. So today, you're talking about China. I just want to know the background, women in China particularly, about how you ended up in China.
Good job we've got a long time. Well, I was at Radio Bristol with yourself, Josephine. I'd been at the BBC for 14 years. I'd worked in London as well as Bristol, so I was on the news channel. I was quite well known in Bristol, and I'd been there quite a long time. And I think you get to a part in your career when you think, well, I can keep on doing this, this is fine. Or being a woman, and I do think it is very much a female thing, you have to, if you want to survive, because success is all about survival, you have to reinvent yourself continually. You can't just say, well, now I'm X, therefore I can cruise. You have to continually think of ways that make you interesting, alluring, and also you still have to be interested in the people you're interviewing. So if I'm really honest, I'd been in Bristol a very long time. I loved Bristol, I loved the West Country. But I wasn't quite sure how much more I could give and how much I could extract. And although I loved talking to the many, many people I interviewed over the years, I thought that I think there has to be something else. My time in the news channel Television Centre was very interesting. I was doing live rolling news. I covered great stories like the Gulf War and the rest of Milosevic. You know, very high profile, the bombing, when that went off, I was there. So it was very challenging professionally. And then I just started to look at China because I have a son. I've been a single parent for, 20 years now. Oh. And so I brought my son up and we have quite a good relationship because when you're just a one-to-one, and he's quite bright and he's also very ambitious and very interested in life. And he'd gone off to Shanghai. And he came back, he was absolutely full of it and said, Mum, you know, China's just amazing. And I was beginning to notice that as I got older, I became less and less visible to the male managers. And I don't mean that in a bitter way. I think as you're an older woman, people are less likely to pay attention to you. The younger girls, quite rightly, you know, need to come forward. And I was often coming across women in the makeup room in London who were crying. I mean, I'm laughing, poor girls. And I'd say to them, why are you crying? And they'd say, well, because everyone's been so bitchy to me. And I said, why are they being bitchy to you? Because I met someone at a party and I got a job presenting and they think I'm not up to it. So I said, well, stop crying and get up to it. Just get good at your job. You've got this. It doesn't matter how you got this opportunity. You've got the opportunity. Use it. So I came across, as I said, quite a few of those crying girls in the makeup room. And I thought, you know what, there has to be something else out there for me. So my son had said about Shanghai. So I thought, well, that's quite a good idea. I'd been to China as a tourist about 10 years previous, but I'd never worked in China. And to be honest with you, I actually thought I'll do anything. And this shows you how naive I was. I thought I'll go to China and I might work in a garden centre. I'll do something completely different. I've spent nearly 30 years in broadcasting. I'll just do something different and find out about China. Anyway, I typed in, along with a friend's daughter who was very good at computers at the time, English-speaking programmes in China, and up came China Radio International. I'd never heard of China Radio International.
No, to be honest, I haven't.
I had no idea where it was, so I looked in there. There was a job as a DJ. And one of the things, as you and I both know, Josephine, we were always told, know your audience, know who you're talking to. And I thought, how am I going to get to know my audience in China? I don't speak Chinese. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I was interviewed by the radio station, China Radio International, by a very nice chap called Li Pishun. And he said, well, clearly you're too qualified for this job and you're too experienced. And why don't you come over and launch a breakfast show?
Wow.
Exactly, my thoughts precisely. So I said, well, just get on a plane and launch your breakfast show. And he said, yeah, you've got so much experience. And again, if I'm really honest, and I don't know if you found this, but when you've been a woman in broadcasting for as long as I have, you know a lot and you don't realise how much you know until you come across people who don't know don't know anything at all.
Or until you go to a dinner party. I find I have so much to say at dinner parties now. Honestly, you know, I remember a few years when I had children, didn't have much to say, and now I'm like world expert on this and that.
Of course, yeah. So I said, well, I'm not sure. I didn't like to say I'm not up to it because he'd obviously got this confidence in me. He said, well, look, come over.
And you'd never even met him.
No, come over. And launch our radio show and host it as well. So I said, well, I'd like to learn Mandarin. I'd like to learn Chinese. He said, okay, we're going to have a Chinese teacher. And I had, honestly, Joseph, if I think how naive, because of the Olympics, like everybody else, I probably assumed China's just a bigger version of Europe. I know it's really daft, especially having gone out there, that you can send postcards and everything's more or less the same and signposts are in English and people speak English. It's not the case at all.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
Anyway, so he said, come over, got on a plane, I arrived in Beijing, and I had a clue what I was doing. I knew nobody, didn't speak the language. It was nothing like I remembered Beijing 10 years prior, when there really were millions of bicycles, whereas now there's 17 million cars.
Yeah, so it's literally a different country.
Totally different, totally different. So anyway, I went there, I spent a month listening to their output, because I wanted to know kind of the style of the programme.
And was it in English then?
English speaking.
Yeah.
So we devised this programme, The Beijing Hour with Susan Osman, and I was to be editor. So I said, well, look, we've got to have a few ground rules here because I don't really know what your expectations are of me. And I'd like to know, you know, because I don't want to start something and it not be a success. So they said, well, let's sit down and have a few rules. So I said, OK, well, you tell me your rules first. So they said, well, our rules are no mention of the Dalai Lama, no mention of Falun Gong and no mention of Tiananmen Square. So I said, well, that's a tricky for the Tiananmen Square because I actually reported on Tiananmen Square when I was at ITN. What if the Dalai Lama dies? We will have to report on the Dalai Lama. The Falun Gong, okay, I can kind of live with that. They said, well, we'll leave it to your discretion, but more or less they're the rules. What's your rule? So I said, well, my rules are no editorial interference, no editorial interference, no editorial interference, because if I'm going to do this programme and it's live, if we're going to have any credibility at all, you've got to let me have a free hand in choosing the stories.
Wow. I can't say this in China. Think about you could have got shot, Susan.
I don't think so. Actually, thinking about it was fairly audacious, if I actually think about it. So, and I said, and not, so my other thing is I want the most senior people. People who speak good English, people who've had some journalistic experience either in the States or...
Is this working with you then?
Working with me, yeah. Because I've got to have a senior person who can steer me in the right direction. Hearts beating loud as thunder, saw the stars crescendo. I've been tragic like I'm Marlon Brando. When I look at my China girl.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
So you had to choose people that work on the programme that spoke English.
I wanted people who spoke very good English. I also wanted people who had sound editorial judgment, because obviously I'd only just arrived in China. I didn't know what was good, bad and different. And when it came to news, I didn't know what the agenda was. I didn't know what expectations were. And I needed to know how the newsroom worked. So there was this amazing guy called Li Yongjing, who was my kind of assistant. We would kind of co-edit it together. And then a team of eight. And the way the programme was structured was that my team, she said grandly, would get into work at 2:30. So they would start collating the stories and bringing in things overnight in the wires. And bearing in mind we're 8 hours ahead, so we often stole a march when it came to stories. Mm. We were often ahead. And then I would come in at about five. And then another thing was I insisted that I read everything that had been written.
Beforehand,
because I couldn't afford for there to be any mistakes, because I knew that everyone would be listening to this programme who was anyone in China, and there would be a lot of people who would be listening who were English-speaking who would also be listening to see if we did have editorial freedom. And there was a lot of attention from the press because of this, and so I was always being interviewed by the Chinese press and various Western papers as well. So I read everything, and it was quite hard work because it was like running a workshop. I had very, very bright people who spoke good English, but they didn't do journalism the way we did journalism. Well, it's they're kind of, I would say, I don't want to kind of say how many years behind, but a few. There's no planning desk. There's no analysis like we have, no natural assumption that the person's not telling you the truth. There's no natural that you're dealing with baddies. So the news was very neutral and diluted, should mm-hmm. we put it that? I think that's the kindest way to put it. And also the writing was a little bit dodgy. The scripts were a bit, that I needed to kind of help them how to write scripts. The Chinese are very, very keen on detail. So let's say a plane crashed. They tell you what model it was, when it was made, the dimension of it, how many people it seated. And they're going, no, we're not interested in the size of the plane. We want to know anyone killed, any survivors, how did it happen? You know, what is the fallout? So it's a clear. And also the other thing is because they hadn't done anything live before, because the programme was divided into sections, because I said I wanted it to be like the Today programme here on Radio 4, that you knew what you were getting at certain times. So we did international news, domestic news, business, sport, entertainment, and so everyone had, there was a structure. So
this is every day, Susan?
Every day I did this, not 5 days a week.
Monday to Friday.
Yeah. It was hard work, and also they had to get in very early in the morning, so, and they were about half my age. And I'd say anyone complaining about being tired, you'll be off the team, because, you know, we can't have people being negative and moaning. We've got to pull together.
What time did it go on?
7 to 8 in the morning. It went out domestically in China. It went out in Australia live, America live. Then it was translated into 62 languages. So I had an audience of between 30 and 40 million. There was an estimate. I mean,
wow.
And it was the most popular programme China Radio International had ever had, which I'm very, very proud of. So I intended to stay there for the first year when I could have established the programme. And then, of course, I loved it so much, I stayed a bit longer. Then the longer I stayed, the more talent I attracted. So I got people from Five Live coming over, from Heart FM, BBC Gloucestershire, someone came over from there.
To go and work at
China Radio International. Yeah. People started hearing about China Radio International because it started to have a bit of credibility. And the thing that was the most popular, which maybe to your eye doesn't seem anything, was the newspaper review. Because if you think you're an English or a European in China and you don't speak Mandarin, you've no idea what's happening in the Chinese newspapers. And if you're Chinese, you've never heard anyone analyse the news. So we had a slot where one of my team would translate all the front pages of the newspapers. And then we had a live guest come in on and choose 3 to 4 stories, which we would then discuss. Mm. And everyone just absolutely loved that slot, because the expats loved it because they got an insight into China. The Chinese loved it because they got an insight into how you analyse news. So it was a kind of a win-win. So that was hugely popular. And I think the programme, because they'd never done anything like that before.
Why did you decide to leave, though? What was your...
Because I'd been there nearly 2 years. My son was about to do his finals at university. I thought it was a good time to come back. We had a morning version of the programme and an evening version of the programme. I'd established a really good routine. I didn't just want to do a programme and then leave. I wanted to have, there was 2 teams of 8. So we had a rota where the morning show team would start work at as I said, 2:30 in the morning. And they'd do 2 months with me and they'd go on to the evening version. And then we kept on rolling it around. So the top, you know, morning team would go on the evening team and vice versa. And they got better and better and better. And by the time they left, they were pretty good. And I thought, right, well, I don't need to be so hands-on. And the other thing I insisted on having was that my co-host should be Chinese, because I didn't want to just it be all about me. Yes, the programme was called The Beijing Hour, Susan Osborne, but I wanted to teach my Chinese colleagues how to broadcast as
fabulous.
Well.
Fabulous. So you were part kind of inspiration, teacher. Did you get a great feeling? Was it a great response from helping other people?
I loved it. I loved bringing on young talent. I loved helping them see how easy it was to be really good and to go from good to being excellent. And just by tweaking. And also it was very professionally affirming because
yes, gave you that mega confidence.
Because I just thought, I'm pretty good at this. Yeah. I know how to do this.
Yes, exactly.
I'm actually
given a chance.
Yes, yeah. I've been given a chance to show what I can do.
Yeah.
And we had some funny times. I mean, I would say to one of my...
Tell me a funny stories.
One of them, I'd say to my business guy, can you get New York on the phone? We need to do X, Y, Z. And he'd go, after 8. And I go, no, now. No, after 8. No, we need to do it now. And they hadn't got the head around it being a live programme. So I came back to the UK, I bought a box of After 8 chocolates. We put it on the desk because he kept saying After 8.
Brilliant.
So that became a bit of a joke. For me, the fun things were doing the Shanghai Expo. They don't have outside broadcast vans. They'd never done outside broadcast before, which is really weird considering they have so many resources and such intelligent people.
Yeah. And the machinery to do it.
It's so extraordinary. So when the Shanghai Expo was there, I said, look, we need to be doing the programme live from the expo. And they looked at me as if I'd kind of stepped out of a cave. I said, no, we really have to be there in Shanghai. You know, what about your OB? Book the OB. And they looked at me and I said, you don't have an OB unit, do you? And they said, no. So I said, OK. So they said, well, leave it with us. So I was called into the office a couple of days later and then this roll of paper was unfurled. And I said, well, what's that? And they said, that's your new studio. And they just built me a new studio in Shanghai and we did the expo from the newly built studio.
Wow.
So it was a fun time. Yeah. I learned a lot about China because of being a journalist. You learn a lot.
Yes.
I learned a lot politically, culturally, historically. I learned about the Chinese. This whole thing about team is so important to them. We're egomaniacs. And I mean that in a nice way as possible, that whenever a Westerner walks into the room, they have to prove who they are immediately. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what they do. Yeah. They have to be the best at whatever. In China, they walk into a room and they watch everybody else and they observe what's going on before they decide to make their move and work out how they're going to be. So when I first was invited to do this program, my boss said to me, look, you know, we really admire you, you know, your expertise, you're very well known, etc. But really what's more important is that you win the hearts and minds of the team. We're not that hung up on ratings. What we want is a good, happy, harmonious environment. That's more important to us than anything else. And of course,
wonderful.
That's not what happens here.
No,
it is ratings, ratings, ratings.
And it's backstabbing and everyone's
We didn't have any of that. None of that. There was never any unpleasantness. There was never any gossiping. It was an absolutely charming environment to work in. We all had breakfast together every day. We'd have team games where we'd make up little stupid things to keep us awake because we were all so tired a lot of the time. We had fun. You know, we got the job done.
They respect each other, don't they? They respect each other in a different way that, you know, we...
Well, it's not so much respect. It's just they know that everybody's important. So everybody within the team was important. So although I was the host and the editor, I sat with everybody. I didn't put myself aside, didn't put my head above everybody else. And even the managers, and there were four managers who were incredibly professional, even they didn't like to be called the boss. It was just they were facilitating and managing the team, but they didn't like to be called the boss. I don't know if you had any idea, but before I went to China, I thought everyone was a communist. But out of the 1.4 billion, only about 17 million are communists.
Only.
You know, it's not that many.
Right.
It's a very small percentage. You have to have a certain type of education to be a communist.
Wow.
It takes a long time to be a communist. I think it comes from Buddhism and Confucianism. I think it comes more from their...
Yes.
spiritual heritage as opposed to their political heritage. Mm. Also, there's no sexual politics like you have over here. So you never had a man flirt with a woman in the office. Never. That would never, ever go on. I mean, you knew there was a little bit of romance going on between person X and person Y, but that was, they were all
in... They never touch each other in public.
No, there's none of that kind of flirting stuff that goes on over here. It was very, very interesting from that, because I couldn't work out why was it I felt more at peace working in the environment that I was working in. It was harder. It was a harder work. I mean, 5 days a week getting up at my age was hard, and to have the responsibility of editing the programme, presenting the programme, and then doing all the post-production.
The buck stopped with you, yeah.
Yeah, it really did. But it was enjoyable because I was valued. I felt I was contributing to a bigger picture. And there was no unpleasantness. I didn't feel that someone was looking over me and waiting for me to make a mistake.
Did you feel you got to know them? Because they always say, you know, the famous thing about being inscrutable.
Did I get to know them? I got to know the managers better than I did my team, I would say. I think the team presented what they wanted me to see. And I think they were very proud to be on the programme. And we launched, for example, a microblog for the programme when I'd been there a few months. And in the first week, I think we got 14,000 hits. I mean, they were proud that the programme was so successful. And I think that still goes on today. They're really proud that they were involved in the programme.
Yeah, what's it called now? Is it still going on?
It's called The Beijing Hour, but with different presenters. My male counterpart in the evening, he's still there. But yeah, the programme's been going, 3 years now?
Amazing. Now, you stopped, but you still spend a lot of time in China. Can you tell us what you're doing out there?
Well, I'm going to tell you something grand now. I've just been made a professor of communication and leadership at the Communication University in China, which means that I teach Chinese politicians and Chinese broadcasters how to do interviews, be interviewed, and communicate their message. And that came about because whilst I was doing China Radio International, I was approached by Blue Ocean Network, BON, which is the only privately owned television company in China. And the owner of the company knew the dean of the university. And when I left, I did a couple of programmes with them. I did a news programme called Beyond the Headlines, and I also did a current affairs programme called China Log. That was also very interesting to do television in China.
Yeah.
That was very different from what I'm used to in the UK as well. I wasn't editor there, I was producer.
Gorgeous lives, living gorgeously. When I look at my China girl,
Radio Gorgeous, podcast for women.
And so when I left and came back to China, I worked a lot with Chinese politicians at the University of Westminster and the China Media Centre. And I worked with people from Guangzhou, Shanghai, Beijing, quite senior people in the PR departments. And they went back and told the dean of the university how they'd had this amazing course with me. And so one thing led to another, so then I was approached by the university to go and be a professor.
So how often are you going to go out there and be doing it?
Well, I'm actually leaving for China tomorrow.
Wow.
I'm going to Beijing for a week and I'll be teaching at the university. I don't know who I'm going to be teaching yet. And then I'm flying down to Yunnan, to Guiyang, and I'm and chairing a panel discussion on the environment. So it's about the eco-sustainability and the environmental emphasis that PR companies are putting on. And it's been endorsed by Xi Jinping and it's quite high profile. So that's
Listen
good.
To you. Sorry, I'm so impressed. So you literally, through the internet, Susan.
Yeah, through the internet.
Through the internet. If it wasn't for the tinternet.
Yeah.
You literally found this radio station and now look at you. You have invented a new career for yourself.
Well, I'm getting there, yeah. I think now I know a lot about China. I have an insight into the Chinese.
Do you love China?
I do love China, and I love the Chinese. And even though I don't speak Chinese, I feel that they get me and I get them. And I'm actually writing a book about my experiences in China called Flirting with the Dragon, which I keep on saying I'm going to finish, but I haven't quite got round to finishing. That's something that really excites me because I think I can bring a freshness to China. I mean, there are lots of academic books, lots of historical books, but I don't think anyone has got the insight that I had. I don't mean to be grand, but because I was a TV and radio journalist in China when no one had done it before, I was sort of like pioneering the way. All sorts of doors opened and I got all sorts of access to all sorts of people at a time when China is really opening up its doors. So I think I can give an insight.
Now, you were saying to me about women in China. So tell us about their status, about their lives. How different are their lives to ours?
Oh, gosh, where do I begin? I thought about this on the way, what I was going to say to you about women generally in China, and I would say that they're incredibly pragmatic. I think any woman over 50 has a story to tell. I mean, you have the Cultural Revolution, you have the fallout from that. I don't think China's yet recovered from the Cultural Revolution. I think anywhere you go in China, that's why I found it so exciting to go as a journalist, everywhere there's a story, and particularly women have a story to tell. And women are very, very strong in China. I don't think that's anything to do with communism, but it's very much a matriarchal society. The men appear to be in charge, but the women are actually, not want to say running the show, but they're very, very important women. And they're
so very respected?
Oh, tremendously respected. Yeah, women are very well respected. They're not like Western women. They're not there to prove that they're like men. They're not there to compete with the men. They just think, well, we're superior, not superior, but we're as good as you anyway. And we've got different strengths and different talents. There's a confidence about Chinese women that Western women don't have, a huge confidence.
I can only think of Chinese men, I'll be honest. I mean, are there women who are famous who are Chinese, you know, in their culture?
Well, Xi Jinping's wife's very famous. She was much more famous before him. She was a singer, very, very well respected. There are very, very rich women. But of course, a lot of Chinese don't want to admit they're rich because it's considered to be braggy. So you never really know who's well-known and not well-known. There's well-known actresses, there's the soaps.
And what about business?
There's a few women in business who've made their money from scrap metal and recycling. But I think it's going to take a while for women to get into very senior management jobs, although China Radio International and Blue Ocean Network both had very, very strong women in very, very strong managerial positions. But I think it's very hard to make a generalisation about women and their work because China's a kind of smoke and mirror society. You kind of don't really know what's going on a lot of the time. So that one man might be making a decision, but actually there's maybe many men and women behind. And I think women are, they take a long view of things. So some of my Chinese friends, for example, they would never argue with their boyfriends in public. They would never let any of their friends know they had marriage problems. They wouldn't be like us.
Immediately
so kind heart to heart. But on the other hand, nothing's off limits. So they're very, very open about what. So they'll ask you questions. Chinese women will ask you, what do you earn? And they'll ask you very intimate questions that you wouldn't expect. Well, that can be also quite telling.
You said something about their sanitary product.
Yeah, well, this is, I don't maybe sound really trivial, but having...
It's not, because we're all women on Radio Gorgeous.
Having lived in China, I knew I had to do two, I had to take shoes, underwear and tampons, because you just can't get tampons in China for love nor money. They just don't use them. They use sanitary towels and I've tried time and time again to find out why, and no one can give me an answer.
You've asked women.
Yes, of course, not the men. I've asked women, you know, why don't you use tampons?
Have they heard of them?
They just look at me as if, well, why would we want to do that? They're just absolutely disgusted by it.
Yeah, maybe they think it's dirty, kind of.
Yeah, I think it's not in their culture. There was one Western shop in Beijing where you
could
get
the most expensive tampons in the world.
you laugh. But it's true, and they probably weren't real either because everything's knocked off in China.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember going for trying to get some Weetabix and baked beans in this shop, and they weren't the real thing. Yeah, no, I used to just bring them over from Boots and in packets. And all my Western friends, if a Western woman went back to get you, they always put in requests, don't forget the tampons, because you just couldn't get them.
Wow. Now, you were saying another thing. So they're tampons and what else?
Child, here in the in the West, we're, you know, give me the air and gas. But in China, that doesn't happen. It's considered that a woman has to suffer when she gives birth because it's a positive suffering. It's a positive way. So a doctor, even if the woman wanted pain relief, she wouldn't be given it.
Oh, that's quite good, actually. I remember actually someone telling me in India as well, women, people never have, when they have their teeth, you know, when they go to the dentist, they'd never have an injection. You know, it's just not, you know, just people accept pain more.
I think probably we're a bit wimpy in the West, aren't we?
Definitely.
I think pain probably can be good.
Yeah.
But we don't like it very much.
Yeah. Well, you know what's wrong with you or what it is if you feel it.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, what is their religion there?
Well, it's multicultural. That's why I liked it so much, because I'm as an interfaith minister, before I went over to China, I was told you mustn't talk about God, you mustn't talk about religion, you mustn't mention this is for my Western people. And I thought, well, why? That's interesting. But I found that whilst I was in China, I talked more about God in China than I ever do in the West. And they're very open to all sorts of cultures. As an interfaith minister going to China, a lot of my colleagues would come and talk to me and say, what does it mean to be an interfaith minister? Can we talk to you about God? And then I would be invited to little church groups, a Bible study group, and they'd meet in cafes. And then I quickly found that every single religion is represented in China. So you've got 80 million Muslims, there's a synagogue, there's a church. And it's not that the Chinese don't want religion. They don't want religion to control people. So they don't want, say, all the Christians to say, we're right, you're wrong, or the Jews to say, we're right, you're wrong. And I started to think about it and wondered why they were like this, because the Falun Gong is a huge spiritual organisation that has received lots of publicity in the past. And the Chinese don't really want to encourage the Falun Gong.
And what's their religion? Is it Buddhist?
It's a spiritual practice. Mm. But there's hundreds of millions of Falun Gong practitioners in China. And I started to think, what is it about the Chinese? What are they so frightened of? Because Buddhism is very, very, very apparent in their culture. Confucianism is very, very strong as well. And I started reading up about the history, and I didn't know this. And perhaps if there's anyone listening, they can tell me a bit more. There's a little paragraph in Chinese history. That's how small, even in Chinese history books. So in about the, I think, early 19th century, there was a man who believed he was the brother of Christ. And he went on a crusade and he killed millions and millions and millions and millions of people. He killed more people than were killed in the First World War.
And it was in China?
In China, because he believed he was Jesus's brother. And I think from that moment onwards, the Chinese thought we must never let that happen again. People must never die in the name of religion. So we'll accept all the religions, but once someone gets too powerful and starts saying to another person, you must do it this way, you must practice being a Jew, or you must practice being a Muslim, then we'll close them down. So what happens in the churches, because Christianity is very much burgeoning, particularly in Beijing and in China itself, if the congregation gets to 20,000 or more, they go along and they close the church down.
What would people do then? Splinter off into groups?
They say yes to go somewhere else. Just keep on moving around.
It's really, really interesting. I mean, I think actually it sounds quite a fair society, and actually they've got a bigger vision than us.
Well, I felt as an interfaith minister it was more healthy, in that all the religions are embraced and all the religions are accepted. And no one was saying, I mean, we're always saying in the UK, we're a Christian society. But why are we a Christian society? There's all sorts of religions now in society. We're multicultural. You know, we can no longer say it's a Christian name. It's a name. And I think that's a big change for us here in the West. And we might not, some people might not like it, but I think that has to be the way forward as we become a global family. We have to embrace all faiths. We have to embrace all beliefs. That's the only way we're going to move forward hand in hand and heart in heart.
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
What are your plans in China for the future then?
Well, I'm going to Beijing tomorrow. I'm going to work at the university.
Yeah, I didn't mean tomorrow. I love that.
And I'll be
tomorrow.
I'll I'll be going backwards and forwards to China at least another two times between now and the end of the year. I'm going to Shanghai TV, the international channel in Shanghai, to do a similar thing. I've worked a lot before in Guangzhou at the documentary festival, and I think just to keep on having a relationship with China, given how this job came about and how the Beijing Hour came about. I think China's a sort of place you can't really plan. It's a spontaneous thing. I mean, I hope that I'll be able to help lots of people, and I hope my relationship with China will strengthen. I'm looking forward to writing my book, and I hope that'll be successful. I've got a lot of people who are interested in China already about the book. I think China's one of those places you can't really have a plan. For example, even though I was getting up so early in the morning, if I wanted to, I could have gone out every single night and stayed out till 6 o'clock every night.
Great.
And just gone from place to place just chatting to people, because it's such a spontaneous city, Beijing.
Fabulous. So when you go out, things happen to you.
Yes.
Oh, like a young person again.
Do you know, funny you should say that. I did feel young again in China. Maybe that's why I like it so much. Maybe it's because I can do stuff in China I can't do over here.
Yeah, it was a freedom and an excitement.
Yes,
and,
possible. Yeah.
Can I just lastly ask, are you famous in China now?
Very. Very. Yeah, very famous. I was in Chongqing a few months ago, and the translator said, oh, you're very famous. You're the very famous Susan Osman. I think it's quite hard to be famous in China. I don't know. I mean, it's...
Well, you do look a bit different than them, because you have got blonde hair.
I suppose I'll stand out.
And you're probably taller than all of them.
That's true, and a lot bigger.
Yeah.
But this particular translator said that on Baidu, which is kind of like our Google page, there was 500 pages of Susan Osman.
Oh!
And hang on, there's more. And there was a competition, you know, Britain's Got Talent. They had a Chinese equivalent. And as it happened, that night, the translator went home and her husband was watching TV. And one of the contestants was asked, you know, what do you want to be? And she said, I want to be Susan Osman.
Made it!
But I think also Susan Boyle helped me because, bless Susan Boyle, I have a great deal of affinity to her. I think it's fantastic what she's done. And her album was released at the same time that I went to China. They hadn't known a Susan before. So Susan Boyle, Susan Osman. And so there was like the double interest.
Susan mania.
Susan's become a maniac, yeah.
It's fantastic to hear all about China, the Chinese, and your career in the media. Wonderful to have you on Radio Gorgeous today. Susan Osman, thank you very much.
Great pleasure, Josephine.
More information about Gorgeous Lives or more Gorgeous Lives, go to radiogorgeous.com. I'll ruin everything you are. You know, I'll give you television. I'll give you eyes of blue. I'll give your man the words to rule the world. And when I get excited, over 1,000 followers can't be wrong. Follow us on @radio_gorgeous on Twitter, darling, of course. Mwah.